RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Summing up my guest today is not a simple matter. He is a historian, an educator, a TV and radio presenter. He is the author of 19 books, a curator, an expert on spaghetti westerns, was rector of the Royal College of Art, chairman of the Arts Council, governor of the British Film Institute, chairman of the Design Council, and is Chancellor of the Arts, University Bournemouth, trustee of the V&A, chairman of the Royal Mint, and an all-round raconteur. I'm exhausted. And if that were not enough, he is a knight, and a knight with an intriguing motto beneath his coat of arms, more of which later. In a word, he is a polymath, and he is Sir Christopher Frayling. This is my first interview for RDI Insights with a non-royal designer, but my reason for this is very simple. Christopher Frayling knows more about our members, our history, and what makes us tick than anyone I know. And like his Victorian hero, Sir Henry Cole, he lives and breathes the importance of design education and has made a major contribution to it during his 30 years at the Royal College of Art, where he presided over many of our faculty members. So it is fitting that we should turn the tables and hear his story. Our interview took place at the home of British cinema, BAFTA, in Piccadilly, on a cold November busy morning there. So apologies in advance for the extraneous noises off. And being at BAFTA, it seemed appropriate to kick off with film. Christopher was born in an ambulance speeding to the hospital on the 25th of December 1946. And I pointed out that that was the very year that Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life was released. And we opened our conversation on that topic.
The very day, it's my birthday. Yeah. It wasn't thought of as a feel-good movie at all at the time. But owing to a historical accident, the fact that no one actually claimed ownership of the copyright, so it was an orphan work, it appeared on television from the 1950s onwards because it was cheap. And a lot of 1960s chaps grew up watching It's a Wonderful Life on television, and it slowly morphed into this great feel-good Christmas movie, which is a very different thing. I think, you know, just as they were coming out of the war, the darkness of the film was hit them much, much harder. You know, because actually, the sort of optimistic bits are in the minority in the film. Most of it's very dark, with this guy looking at his life. Has it been worthwhile? Have I touched people's lives? Nothing's worthwhile, etc. Very gloomy sort of post-war message. Now, it's the ultimate feel-good movie, and this and Miracle on 34th Street are the two films that you have to watch at Christmas.
There's A Matter of Life and Death,
yes,
of course.
Yes, absolutely. Escalator to Heaven, yes.
Absolutely. And then there's The Best Years of Our Lives, which is a wonderful film. Yes. My Darling Clementine.
Oh, of course. I'd forgotten
Ford.
That.
Ford.
Yes, yes, quite.
Notorious.
Yeah, great. Classic, yeah.
The Big Sleep and Brief Encounter, of course.
Oh, wow.
So, pretty good year.
Pretty good.
Pretty good year. On to film. Mm. You got, I think when you were probably in your perhaps mid to late 20s, you got a job at the Imperial War Museum researching amateur footage, which went on to contribute to The World at War.
Yes, that's
fantastic
right.
Series.
TV series. Yes, when I left university, I didn't want to become a history academic. I wanted to find a kind of practical history. And it struck me that, you know, film as historical evidence and actually looking at film, looking at the raw materials of film and assembling them was a really interesting way of looking at practical history, as it were. And in fact, I got introduced to art schools lecturing on film and history. And that's how I got in originally. But I got this job at the War Museum in the film department as a research assistant, and it was basically cataloguing uncatalogued footage. There's a secret government film vault at Hayes, Middlesex, consisting of lead-lined vaults, because it's all nitrate stock and it could go up at any minute, you know, because all official film in the Second World War was made on nitrate stock, which is very unstable. And it's absolutely full in those days of uncatalogued material, just cans and cans of film. So I sat there in this darkened, lead-lined room with a Steenbeck machine, one of those, you threaded up your celluloid and all this, two plates, and catalogued. I did the RAF footage. I did, for my sins, I did some of the concentration camp footage, which is very difficult to just sit there in a darkened room watching this stuff and taking card index notes, which would then turn into punch cards, which would then go into computers. And part of it ended up on television in The World at War. There were many researchers on that programme. The World at War, the great gimmick was colour. You know, BBC Two had begun with The Great War, which was, of course, black and white. So Thames wanted to go one better. And so a desperate search for colour footage of the Second World War.
Yes.
And so we put small ads in newspapers right across Europe for home movie footage.
Right.
And we discovered that all these cine buffs in Germany and France particularly had a lot of colour footage that they'd made on 8mm. And some of the World at War was actually constructed out of home movie footage because the official footage wasn't, well, not much of it was in colour. So that was quite exciting going through all that.
I'm sure you've seen the Peter Jackson.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed, I have.
Which is extraordinary.
Amazing. And funnily enough, now there's an extraordinary story there. While I was at the War Museum, the oral history archive was frantically interviewing a lot of veterans of the First World War who were still alive. And of course, the voiceover in Peter Jackson's is entirely made up of a collage of that oral history archive from the War Museum. But I was watching the Peter Jackson film last week, and I looked at the credits at the end, and it lists all the witnesses that they used, all the voices. Brian Frayling, engineer. It was my great-great uncle was one of the witnesses. He was in the Royal Engineers, which were responsible for actually constructing the trenches. And when you hear the voiceover in that film of someone talking about the construction of the trenches, how they were built and all the rest of it, it's Brian Frayling. I never knew that until I saw that film.
That's
I couldn't believe it.
I mean, it's a wonderful contribution to the Imperial War Museum from him.
Yeah, no, it was great. I mean, and to do that, you know, when they were still around, it was such a far-sighted thing to do. I also did at the War Museum, I contributed to an exhibition on the real Dad's Army, which was on at the time. I had to do the weaponry. And my other great contribution to the War Museum was they were building a thing called the Trench Experience in the gallery for the First World War.
I went to that.
And there was to be, I think, a royal opening. And they wanted an ammunition mule, which they hadn't got. And in those days, there was a government taxidermist who stuffed for England. He stuffed animals for natural history museums all over the country. And so we got in touch with the government taxidermist. Could we have a stuffed mule, please, in time for the opening? And I'll always remember this. This huge crate arrived just before the opening, and we opened it, and this beautiful mule that looked like an extra from Bambi appeared with big eyes and eyelashes. And I said, they can't possibly put that in the Trench Experience. It looks much too nice. So we had to sit there pulling tufts out of this mule to make him look a bit moth-eaten and then cover him in ammunition belts and all the rest of it. And he was there till quite recently. I used to go to the War Museum and say, that's my great contribution to the War Museum. But I think he's moved on now, and they've rather improved the Trench Experience.
You already mentioned the Steenbeck, so we'll carry on in film mode. Let's spool back. On the Steenbeck to your childhood. You were born in 1946, as we've already said, just a year after the end of World War II. You lived in fairly comfortable circumstances in Hampton. Your father, Arthur Frayling, was a furrier and worked for the Hudson Bay Company. For some reason, I can't stop thinking of Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant.
Well, my father used to spend several months a year in Canada because the headquarters of the Hudson's Bay Company was in Winnipeg. And he'd go and visit the Inuit people, we used to call them Eskimos in those days, and persuade them to use the Hudson's Bay Company as an auction house to sell their furs. Because in the 50s, the fur trade was booming.
Yes,
now, it dare not speak its name.
Yes, yes.
And Wimbledon is where we lived in South London. I was born in an ambulance just outside Hampton Court Palace. I was early. And so Hampton is where allegedly I was born.
I see.
Never lived there. And then we lived in South London, yeah.
And of course, your mother was a rally driver. And she won the 1952
RAC rally. Yes.
In a beautiful Allard.
Allard, exactly.
And I just checked something. Just a year before, in 1951, Sheila Van Damme, race in the Monte Carlo Rally, and Hilma Minx. Hilma Minx, which I thought was extraordinary.
Yes, yes.
There's a beautiful Allard.
Well, there were a whole bunch of people who were the kind of circle of rally drivers. Raymond Baxter, who subsequently presented that sign, Tomorrow's World.
Tomorrow's World.
There was Sheila Van Damme, who was connected with the Windmill Theatre.
Yes.
There was Barry Appleby, who did The Gambles, that strip cartoon in the Daily Express.
Yes, of course, for long running.
Because it wasn't quite professionalised yet, the rally driving world. And in fact, shortly before she died, I escorted my mother to the 50th anniversary of the RAC rally at the RAC Centre in Chester. And they had the March of the Champions. And it really did my heart good for two reasons. One woman, 49 men, because she was the only survivor. But secondly, all the 49 men seemed to be sort of sun-bronzed Finns dressed in a sporty outfits, looking as though they were going skiing. And my mum was just normally dressed in a kind of everyday outfit with a scarf. It was sort of well-meaning amateurs who knew a bit about cars in those. Yeah. And then suddenly in the mid-50s, I think it got professionalised and became what it is today. But it did me good to watch this. And then she was interviewed by Top Gear and all this, which rather baffled her, but that was rather exciting.
Because of the busyness of your father and your mother's ambition, it meant that you and your brother, Nicholas, were packed off to boarding school at a very young age. You were six.
I was six,
which is very young.
It is. And the theory was that my brother was 2 years, 10 months older than me, that he went off and that I should go off at the same time, so because we'd go together. It showed a complete misunderstanding of how boarding schools work, which is that six-year-olds don't speak to nine-year-olds. You know, you're in a separate sphere, and it's absolutely not done for the mature students to talk to the less mature ones. So it was doubly awful. I was there, but I wasn't in any contact with my brother.
Yes.
No, I wouldn't do that to any offspring of mine. It was more common in those days. But
absolutely, yeah. So what are your childhood memories as such? I mean,
oh, boy. Well, growing up in Wimbledon, this may be retrospective, but American popular culture was the great thing. There was a Western on television every night.
Yes.
We all dressed up as cowboys and Indians. I was always preferred to be a cowboy. The imagery of sort of that kind of America was absolutely everywhere. My memory of my childhood is completely saturated in that at home. School, highly regimented. Evelyn Waugh's book, Decline and Fall, about this rather strange prep school where they're all sort of war veterans from... in his case, the First World War, none of whom have a teaching qualification amongst them, but they're all eccentric. It was very, very like that. The school
really?
I was at, yeah. I mean, there was the history master, in fact, had written a spy novel called Enter a Spy, claimed to have invented James Bond. He was a war veteran, had been got a medal in the First World War, drove a BSA Bantam motorbike, very, very eccentric, hadn't a clue about teaching, but he was a sort of hero to us because of his war record and so on. They were all a bunch of strange sort of misfits in retrospect. All boys, of course, it was a single-sex school. And I can't say I enjoyed it, but like a lot of people going to boarding school, it encouraged me to develop a kind of double life. Where there's school life and there's home life. And when parents ask you, what do you think of school? Fine. What's the food like? Fine. And you develop this sort of inner life. You know perfectly well you don't enjoy it very much, but you would never admit it.
And did you have that system whereby every Sunday you would write a letter home saying wonderful everything was?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. On lined paper, supervised by the scripture mistress who looked over me. Woe betide you if you say anything negative.
Well, almost like First World War postcards being censored. Let's move on.
In fact, sorry, just one memory of that. That relates to the subject in hand. When I was first at school, we all went, I remember this very, very clearly, single file. The nearest little town was called Hassocks in Sussex.
Yeah.
And there was a little cinema there. So we were allowed to go and see The Robe with Richard Burton because it had a biblical theme.
Yes.
And the scripture mistress went to see it and sort of vetted it before we went and thought it was sort of ideologically sound, so we could all go. So we all went crocodile fashion to see this film. Widescreen, CinemaScope, and I'd never seen anything like that. Colour, nice sound, Richard Burton, I think Gene Simmons. Anyway, so that was quite a formative thing. But she wouldn't take us to the sequel, Demetrius and the Gladiators, because she thought it was too pagan. So we only saw the one. But the other thing was that also in Hassocks was the great weaver. You may have wanted to talk about this later, but the great weaver Ethel Mary, who was the first woman RDI in the 1930s.
Yes, yes, yes.
A friend of Eric Gill, part of that Ditchling group.
Yes.
And we all went, when I was 7 or 8, to this little bungalow called Gospels to be taught weaving by a very, very elderly lady and her assistants, because there was a slight arts and crafts philosophy in this school about, everyone learned a bit of weaving, a bit of basket work, painting, the crafts as well, handicrafts as well as fine art. And looking back, it was Ethel Mary in the year before she died.
Good heavens.
But we just thought she was a terrifying old lady who walked around as we... I've still got the table mat that I produced that day, and it's suspiciously good. And I have this lovely feeling that she must have held my hand and done it for me, because it's all the edges are beautifully lined up and all the rest of it. But so I touched the arts and crafts, the
very
tail end
early,
of the arts
yes.
and crafts movement.
Yes.
We're just dying out. out, you know, the Gill, Ethel Mary, you know, Cockerell, all that generation who lived in Sussex. I just touched the end of it by going to school there, but I didn't realise it at the time. No. Of course, it was only a long time later that when I helped to open an exhibition about Ethel Mary in Bath at the Holborn Museum, which came to the Crafts Council, that I suddenly saw the connection, and so I was able to talk about this in a speech and in a dramatic flourish produced by Table Mat.
Interwoven, as it were, with a lot of connections
over the years.
Obviously, you were destined to do what you do. So we'll move on a bit. There was Repton, and then on to Churchill College, Cambridge, read history.
Yeah.
And then you left, and I think you were at a short while at Exeter University.
Yes, I was at Cambridge from 65 to 68, while Churchill College was being built around us. You know, it was this new modern college that, just before he died, Churchill said he wanted a college that emphasised technology and design and engineering and modern subjects, and had as its motto, happy is he who knows the cause of things. So it was a predominantly science and technology college, but it was being built, and we felt like pioneers. I was only the second generation doing history there.
Right.
There'd only been one year before me who'd ever done history at Churchill, and I loved that idea.
Yeah.
Beautiful rooms, very modernist, the architecture, anglepoise lamps, central heating. All my friends in the more traditional cottages were living in leaky rooms where the windows didn't close, but they got all the tradition. I got all the modernism and the comfort, so they all came to visit me.
So that environment had an effect,
definitely. Where one would sit in the student bar routinely rubbing shoulders with scientists, technologists and engineers in a way that in traditional university you just didn't. You only met other historians.
Exactly.
And that definitely had an interest.
I mean, and traditionally in an antiquated background. Let's wind on a bit more now. So in 1979 you were appointed Professor of Cultural History at the Royal College.
Yep.
Now the Royal College was to become a massive part of your life.
Very much so.
We'll concentrate a bit on that.
Yeah.
You had your own particular take on cultural history, and I think I'd be interested to talk a little bit about how you expanded the scope of it or introduced, you know, more popular areas may have been frowned upon by others, thinking they were not academic enough.
After the War Museum, I became a one-day-a-week tutor at the RCA in a department that was called General Studies, run by Christopher Cornford. And the students at the RCA, when it became a university in the late 60s, had to write an essay and had to go to a course, rather reluctantly, in General Studies. And General Studies was basically history of art with one or two add-ons. Iris Murdoch was one of the teachers there. She taught art in relation to philosophy. And it was a really interesting assortment of people, actually. But in 79, when I applied for the professorship, what I thought was various things. First of all, why isn't someone doing the history of design? Secondly, why aren't they doing the history of film? And why is it that rather traditional idea that in art schools everyone aspires to be an artist, everyone must do the history of art, it struck me as rather old-fashioned.
Yeah.
So why don't we do the history of the disciplines that surround you, and indeed the things that are in the high street?
Yes.
Why don't we do, you know, history isn't Caravaggio, it's what's on at the Odeon.
Exactly.
It's also what's on at the Design Centre in the Haymarket.
Yes.
Late lamented.
Of course.
And all that.
Yes, yes.
And so I really wanted to develop those areas, which I did as a prof. I mean, I set up the History of Design program with the V&A, which was the first postgraduate History of Design program in the country. There had been a couple of undergraduate courses, one at Brighton, one at Middlesex. But I was very excited about that and built all sorts of bridges with the British Film Institute and all these other things for the film side of it. But also to try and sort of loosen up the department so it wasn't, you know, Russian for engineers, or you know, something you do on Thursday afternoon rather reluctantly when you should be in the studio. It was something that might excite the students and they might actually want to know about. So that was basically what I was doing, and it was very unusual in those days to make the transition from university land to art school land. And it was quite a risk in a way. Today it's much more common, you know, largely because all the art schools have turned into universities.
Yes.
But in those days, it was a very separate world. And I remember when I applied for the professorship, the Association of University Teachers, which is the union, phoned me up and said, "Are you sure you want to do this?" They actually phoned me up, and I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Well, it's insecure, it's volatile, they're all a bit mad. It's like going into sort of foreign foreign territory, you're a university chap. You know, you get a tenured contract after 3 years, and you know, a nice career progression, a pension, and they said this is really quite a dangerous move. I said, that is the point. I really find that a very exciting thing to be doing.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I haven't regretted it for a second. And one of the reasons why I did it, this is a tiny anecdote, but I remember I gave a lecture when I was a one-day-a-week tutor at the college on Victorian comics, penny dreadfuls, cheap woodcuts, and Victorian comics.
Yeah.
And I asked if there were any questions. There weren't any questions. There never are. Everyone's a bit shy. And I forgot almost about it, really. And then about 8 months later, I went to the summer show, and one of the graphic students, his entire display was variations on Victorian comics. I'd changed that lad's life that afternoon without realising it. And I'd never experienced that kind of satisfaction in lecturing in university. Where the thing in university land is, you give the lecture, someone writes it down more or less accurately, they give it back to you at exam time. But this was completely different. It had become part of this boy's personality. And I thought, wow, that is amazing.
And also you particularly have a... It's very clear in the areas that you're interested in, you have a visual... aesthetic. I mean,
very much so.
You know, looking is
very much so. And I did feel that you know, university land was for me too verbal, and it didn't allow for the visual enough. You know, film as historical evidence, that was unusual.
Yes.
Using visual evidence instead of documents in history, that's always intrigued me. And so, yes, the visual side was very important.
Yes.
And so I applied for the professor. And I was very young. I mean, I think I was the youngest professor of humanities in the country for
really?
A time.
Really?
I was in my early 30s. Didn't know how to spell the word budget, but I learned quite quickly. And mind you, I had that in common with most of the professors at the college, actually, and got it, really, against all the odds. And it was quite difficult because all the members of the department were older than me, the ones that I inherited, and were part of the old regime of general studies. A wonderful group of people, very, very eccentric again, but... You know, and I had to somehow make it my own. And it took quite a time to earn my spurs, really.
Yes.
You know, to here was a guy from university land, slightly suspicious. He's not an art school chap, because I never went to art school myself.
Yeah.
Walking into this culture, and I had to get their respect.
Yes.
And one of the reasons why I developed a lot of practice outside the college, television work, writing and so on, was that I quickly learned that the way to get respect, both of the students and staff, was not by what you say, but by what you do.
By doing stuff.
Yeah. And then you could show, you could say, you know, famously, the first lecture of the year is, I'm going to show you what I do, and with any luck, you'll listen to me for the rest of the year if you respect what I do. And so I developed this kind of other life as part of that.
And you had the time to do that. I mean, the post at the Royal College, was that full time?
Oh, yeah, it was absolutely
so full-time. You managed to squeeze
evenings,
all the
weekends.
Because
I mean,
because you're writing, your television, your
radio.
It
tends to be the domestic side that goes off the edge, I'm afraid.
Yes.
I've always been very, very energetic and wanted and very active and firing on lots of cylinders at the same time. I'm that sort of person. Slight tendency to workaholism, I guess, but believing quite strongly that, you know, just as in the studio departments, they tended to work for 1 day a week on their own practice. So graphic designers would go off to their studios on Mondays or Fridays or whatever. I felt, whereas in the theory, theory department, there wasn't a tradition of that, that there should be. And there should be an equivalent to that practice, which is your own writing, your own TV, whatever it is.
So traditionally you should have been in the senior common room just having a nice glass of wine and chatting
sitting in
to
the library
friends.
Preparing a lecture.
Yes. Well, obviously that whole experience prepared you very well for what happened next, which is in 1996 when you became the rector of the Royal College.
Yeah.
And so you were now, to all intents and purposes, in control of the ship. You came from the engine room up onto the bridge.
No, exactly, the inside candidate, which I thought would be a great disadvantage. But, of course, they had recently appointed a very outside candidate in the form of Jocelyn Stevens, who is from the newspaper world, very robust. Our Thatcher years at the Royal College were our Stevens years.
Yes.
And so after that, and he'd been quite a ruthless manager, quite a headbanger.
I'd heard that he was extremely ruthless.
He was, and you know, and he bought the old Fleet Street ideology. You know, if the front page isn't right, you fire the editor until the front page gets right, and you keep firing the editor until the front page gets right. He had rather that view of how to run the Royal College. So when I pitched for becoming rector, it was an extraordinary opportunity to put the heart back into the place and to have a more sort of consensual, from the ranks, trying to understand what made the professors tick approach rather than a head-banging approach from outside. I didn't see it as a management problem, I saw it as a leadership problem,
right,
which is a very different thing.
You know,
I wasn't just moving chess pieces around, I wanted to bring them with me.
Right.
And so it was just the right moment for me, really, to be in the post-Stevens rector.
Well, I want to go back a little earlier than that, because I want to talk a little bit about Robin Darwin.
Yeah.
Because Robin Darwin was selected after he'd written a paper on design education for the Design Council.
That's right.
I think he applied.
That's right. Council of Industrial Design.
That's
in those
right.
Days.
Council
yeah.
of Industrial.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously the powers that be thought this chap is just the job. He went to Slade. He studied painting, and he moved into that position in 1948, I think,
yes,
just
that's
before.
Right. That's right.
When all of the young designers were finishing off national service and getting their helped financially with local councils and so forth, and drifting in the doors. And he had a very sedate sort of structure in terms of what yeah. would be taught. It almost harked back to a sort of slightly earlier period.
Yes.
And what seemed to happen is that as we moved in and younger people came in who had been exposed to a lot of what you've said earlier, America being yeah. a big influence.
And national service.
National service too, yes. Many that went to Central, for example, and studied under Anthony Froshard, you know, were seeing sort of dynamic typography, were very disappointed when they got to the Royal College, because there was this rather almost Victoriana, Egyptian expanded approach to design. And so they sort of rather rebelled. This is the students.
Yes, yes, quite. Particularly
and
in graphics. Yeah.
In graphics. Mm. They thought to help. They were told that they couldn't use photography. He didn't recognize that as an
That's
art
right.
form. And if you look at all the ARC magazines, they're very centered classical typography until some younger designers like Len Dayton and
well, David
Dennis
Gentleman.
David Gentleman. Well, David was actually quite happy under I think he was very much influenced by what came after.
Yeah.
And so slowly somebody put a photograph on ARC,
yeah.
which infuriated.
Yeah. Ridley Scott made a film.
So I just wondered,
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in terms of, you're being slightly unfair to Darwin,
I think.
But there is an element of that, because oddly enough, you know, I've mentioned how I moved from university land into art school land in a very positive way. Darwin did the opposite. He grew up in a Cambridge clan. You know, that the Darwins were part of, like the Keyneses, and there were these big clans of families in Cambridge. Gwen Raverat wrote a book called Period Piece, which is all about those families. And he wanted to turn the Royal College into King's College Cambridge, hence the senior common room, fellowships, all this kind of language of Cambridge.
Yeah.
So in a way, he was trying to do the opposite of what I was trying to do, which is art schools were treated as the tradesman's entrance. He wanted to raise their esteem and turn them into the equivalent of Oxbridge.
Yes.
But this is where I think there's a bit of the plus. I once had a conversation with David Hockney about art education, and he said, the thing is that the cardinal sin in art education is not having a strong point of view. That if you're part of a system where a student arrives and everybody agrees with you, and the system is like sponge, and every time you press it, it goes in, he said, that's no use at all. You don't learn anything. But if you've got someone with whom you profoundly disagree, a kind of dialectic occurs.
Yeah.
And he said that's what he felt like with Carol Waite, who was his professor of painting, and all that kind of traditional figurative painting.
Yes.
He was constantly arguing. They said, we don't like pop art, we don't like sort of graphic-type painting, but he's fighting that, and out of that fight, he found his own voice.
Yes.
So in a funny way, Darwin's establishment approach produced some really, really interesting students out
Absolutely.
Of combustion, fighting
yes.
it,
yeah,
as in graphics. In fact, where Guyot had to, you know,
yes.
held, was like the little boy in the legend of putting his finger in the dike to stop the flood coming through. He was trying to stop the flood of pop art and
yes.
All this jazzy things that were going on. But he couldn't. And out of that came the latter days of ARC, where it got really interesting.
Well, in fact, that led to, really, I would say, to what became, you know, the swinging 60s, but that
yes.
wonderful explosion
yes.
of everything, mainly due to the Royal College.
Yeah.
Because if you look at all those innovators at the time, so many went through the Royal College.
Yeah.
I mean, it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, during your tenure there as rector, what you presided over a lot of changes. So digital, for example, came in, which is a major change.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just wondered how your time there. What were the high points?
Well, the first thing is the appointment of professors. That there's been a tendency in art education for career academics to take over from the practitioner teacher. And I felt very, very strongly that one of the keys to the RCA is to find, you know, where the action is out there in the professional world, so we say of design, and try and encourage them to come in and teach. And that the way to do that is to protect them from administration. So, you know, I went to get Ron Arad because I thought he'd be absolutely fantastic for energizing industrial design, for bringing together the furniture department and the industrial design department into one department called product design. Actually, being Ron, he had to call it design products, but it was product design. But then you put in a number two underneath him who goes to the committee meetings, does all the paperwork, does the budgets, to release Ron entirely for teaching. Because if you bring Ron in and put him on a committee for 3 days, it is a complete waste of his talents. He's terrible at it, he admits it, and why do it, you know? So Ron, Nigel Coates, various professors that I brought, I would consider that one of the major achievements, hanging on to that idea.
So a sort of curatorial approach.
Yeah, in a way. But also trying to make them feel that it was worth coming to the college, that it was exciting to meet the students. Mm. It was good fun to have lunch in the senior common room. There was something sort of good about being there, and then for maybe 2-3 days a week, but it was pure teaching.
Mm.
So I think that was part of it. I think, yes, the digital thing. I mean, one of the great challenges was in the craft departments, ceramics, jewellery and so on, where digital manufacturing came in.
Mm.
It produced a kind of crisis in teaching in the 1980s where, if, for example, you've got a piece of jewellery and someone draws it on a screen, puts it into three dimensions, and then plugs it into a machine that looks like a microwave oven, and it produces that piece of jewellery out of resin or wax, then all the think work, all the design work is at the front end.
Yeah.
It's in the drawing. You've got to understand the materials you're dealing with in the drawing.
Yeah.
Whereas in the arts and crafts philosophy, it's all in the making at the other end.
Yeah.
So that's huge. I mean, it's a profound change in the teaching. And that all happened when I was there, particularly because rapid prototyping in those days tended to be for small scale things, so it was very jewellery, ceramic, things like that were the departments which were most affected. Subsequently, of course, the students all came to me, we want one to do cars full size, and geez, where are you going to put it, you know? But at that stage it was all rather small scale, so yes, I had to cope with that, and all the tensions that brings, where people felt as an article of faith that the making, the thumbprints were very, very important, when actually all the technology was pushing in a different direction.
Yes.
So that was an exciting thing to be involved in. And I set up courses on curating contemporary art. I was very interested in how, just as academics had dominated art history, that academics were dominating curatorship. And that wouldn't it be interesting to actually grow curators of contemporary art side by side with the practitioners in the studios from within art schools?
Mm.
So I set up this Curating Contemporary Art course, which had a huge impact. I remember going to the opening of Tate Modern, and half my graduates were standing there in black T-shirts, the Tateettes, all in a row, and they'd all come through the Curating Contemporary Art.
Yes.
It was just that moment where, because of the National Lottery, a lot of art buildings were going up.
Yes.
Or the old buildings were being refurbished, and there were huge opportunities for curators.
Yes.
It really was a gold rush, actually. And,
yes.
And so it was just the right moment to do that. So I'd say that was part of it. But mainly, persuading successive governments, and this was a very hard work, actually, to take the RCA and art schools in general more seriously.
Yes.
And to play on this great phrase, the creative industries had come in 1996. Actually, historians like me knew that it had been around since the 1930s, when it was intended as an insult.
Yeah.
You know, that all these sociologists from the Frankfurt School said, creative industries, you're linking a soft word with a hard word, and we don't like industry very much, and it's all fascistic anyway. So creative industries were thought to be a baddie, but suddenly the same phrase turns up in 1996 as a goodie. Isn't it great? Here's a whole sector of the economy we haven't noticed before.
And at the time, of course, the Tony Blair and the Labour Party embraced many. I, along with many other designers, went to Downing
Street,
and we were thanked for our contribution and
so on.
And then within a few years,
I know. It went away dead. Again. I know. And now, of course, the big phrase is productive industry, which is very different.
Yes.
No, it was a wonderful moment. The design graduates felt wanted, and that gave the place a sense of confidence. Mm. The professors encouraged that kind of confidence because they could see, you know, the students could see the Rons and the Nigels and all these people, you know, doing very well at the time. There was a real sense of the place buzzing, there really was, and we were getting big resources from the government for that reason. It was a very, very exciting time to be there, actually. It wasn't going to last, but it was one of those moments where art schools moved centre stage. Mm. And, you know, when they started talking about designers and intellectual property in the House of Commons, do you know, that was the first time they'd talked about that subject since Charles Dickens, when Charles Dickens was worried about copyright because everyone was pirating, you know, the Christmas Carol and things like that. That was the last time they'd actually had a public debate about the importance of intellectual property. And so, I mean, you know, it was quite new, all this stuff.
Yes.
Bliss it was in that dorm to be like, I'm slightly, you know, sentimental about it in retrospect.
Of
and
course.
It had its tensions. But you know, when I could go and see the minister and have a face-to-face meeting and talk about it.
Yeah.
And I also decided at the time that it's quite important to be as near the White House as possible, as it were. So I became chairman of the Design Council and chairman of the Arts Council at that time.
Yes.
Because I kind of felt, right, this is the moment to get into the corridors of power and persuade them about the importance of all this. So it was all of a piece, actually. Exhausting, I can
bet. Tell you. I mean, you're taking on the post as chairman of the Arts Council. The tables were sort of turned because at the Royal College you were obviously waiting to hear what sort of contribution you'll be getting from government. And there you were sitting in the chair deciding on who should get the money.
Yeah.
That must have been an extraordinary situation.
Well, it was interesting. It was interesting because I was actually, bizarrely, I was chairman of the Arts Council and the Design Council simultaneously, which no human being has ever done and no human being should ever try and do again. It was an extraordinary moment. It struck me that most of the members of those senior committees in the arts aren't practitioners, and certainly the you know, they tend to be arts administrators and all this sort of thing, and notably on the Design Council, but also on the Arts Council at that time. And the last person who chaired the Arts Council who actually worked in the arts simultaneously was Kenneth Clarke in the early 1950s, where he was head of the National Gallery at the time that he chaired the Arts Council. Since then, it had been ex-ministers, business people, senior civil servants who had an interest in the arts but weren't themselves working in the arts.
Mm.
And there's pluses and minuses. The plus was I managed to get many, many more practitioners onto the Arts Council, and I knew quite a lot of people, certainly in the visual art and design worlds. The minus was that I was so close to it that, I mean, I occasionally had to give bad news to people I knew quite well.
Yes.
And because they had my home phone number, they'd phone me at 2 a.m, saying, what the bloody hell do you think you're doing? And that, I was very close to it. And that made it quite tense.
I'm sure.
So I began to realise that sometimes to be a bit detached from it is not necessarily a bad thing.
Mm.
But on the whole, I think it was a plus. No, it was tough. It was tough. And they always say, you know, when you go for these roles, they say, oh, it'll be half a day a week. Now, they know it's 2 days a week. I know it's 2 days a week. But we all say it's half a day a week in order to get me to do it.
Yes.
It's a sort of game that everyone plays.
Yes.
So, I mean, if you added up the Arts Council, the Design Council, and the College, and the TV and writing work, I think it was about sort of 14 days a week.
Yes.
And so I had to cram a quart into a pint pot for several years.
And also a few years before that, of course, you were knighted for your services to art and design education.
Yeah, that was pre the Arts Council.
Oh, yes. That was 2001.
Yes, and that was part of this, you know, the creative industries, the centrality of the Royal College, and a few other things that I'd been involved in. I'd been on the Crafts Council, I'd been a governor of the BFI, but also I was involved in the Millennium Dome, and I was the person in charge of the faith zone. Now, that's another story, but originally the idea of the Millennium Dome, which was actually quite a good one, was mind, body and spirit.
I remember.
That you'd have the mind zone, the body zone and the spirit zone. And then the Church of England cut up rough because I came up with this idea in the spirit zone of a journey. I'd read a book by a man called Joseph Campbell called The Hero with a Thousand Faces. By the way, it's the book on which George Lucas got the idea for Star Wars, which is a quest. What this book does is it boils down the great stories of Muhammad, Jesus, King Arthur, Dante, you name it, into one big story. right? That there's elements that all these stories have in common, which is you start out on a quest, you reach all sorts of obstacles, there's possibly a damsel in distress, you go through all sorts of adventures, and you come back to where you started, only you understand it for the first time. And he applies this to all the great stories, you know. And I thought, wouldn't it be great in the Spirit Zone to have a journey which is depicted graphically with all these sort of obstacles on it, which applies to all world religions? And that's, I spent about a year on that. And then suddenly the Church of England said, it's much too loose. You know, the whole point of the Millennium Dome, it's celebrating 2,000 years since the birth of Christ. So it's too diffuse, it's too multi-denominational. Spirit is a bit, so let's call it the Faith Zone. They changed the name. And I thought Faith Zone sounded like a bad 50s pop singer, you know, Faith Zone and the Zonettes. But that completely ruined my idea. So we couldn't do that anymore. So we then had to reconsider it from the point of view of people's attitude to Christianity. Now, there were some good things in the zone. James Turrell's sculpture at the end was amazing as a kind of chill-out zone, which became very popular to get away from the rest of the dome.
And the central show with Peter Gabriel's work and the circus.
Circus school.
Which is wonderful. I took my kids along.
I know. The trouble was that, it's a long story, but partly the great expectation. I mean, I remember the Walt Disney Organization writing from Paris saying that the kind of audience figures that they were aiming for in the dome took Disneyland Paris 2 years to reach.
Yes.
And they said, you're going to do it in 6 months?
Totally.
It was crazy.
Unrealistic.
It was. And so it was set up to fail in a way. That having created these ridiculous expectations, the press immediately said, well, oh God, it's been a disaster. Actually, the numbers weren't bad.
No.
And they were better than Disneyland Paris for the first 6 months.
Yes. It was one of those terrible political things where no matter what was going to be done, there would have been a lot of...
But I think also that there was... they were pushed by the sponsors a bit too much.
Yes.
They weren't strong enough,
I
don't think.
Yes.
And they wanted to do another 1951. I remembered going to the South Bank just... I was five. But I do remember... I remember going to the Dome of Discovery. I remember going on Emmett's Railway, the chittering railway, whatever it's called, and the Skylon. Now, I do remember all that, and I remember there was a big story, which was, let's take modern things seriously.
Yes.
And I do remember that. There wasn't a big story in the dome. There was no grand narrative holding it together.
Mm.
There were lots of diffuse bits, and some of the bits were quite good, the circus, and et cetera, Tyrrell sculpture. Some of the bits weren't very good.
Yeah.
But there was nothing to hold it together like 1951, where you had a spine, which was, you know, modernism.
And, of course, you had, the Second World War. It was all about looking for a better future.
Yeah, and everyone, and also, I mean, I remember Hugh Casson giving a lecture at the Royal College about the 1951, where he said, look, we come out of the war, we were used to command and obey. And so you had a bunch of designers with rather large egos, but they were used to obeying, and they mobilized the troops all for this one idea.
Yes.
By the time that the Millennium Dome came out, everyone's going in separate directions.
Yes.
It was like herding cats.
Yes.
And command and obey, forget it.
Yes.
Unfortunately, they didn't keep the lid on it quite enough.
Another little bit of frivolity. Your knighthood means that you have your own coat of arms, of course, and I want you to tell the listeners what the motto is below your coat in Latin,
and
then the translation.
Yes, yes, quite. Well, you have to choose the iconography, you know, of your crest, but also the motto underneath. And I went to a scholar in Oxford to get a translation, and in Latin it goes, Purge scelus fecit mihi diem perficias. And I went to the heralds, and they looked at it and said, proceed, varlet, make my day perfect. I said, yes, something like that. It is, of course, go ahead, punk, make my day. It's the nearest they could get.
That takes me neatly onto Clint Eastwood, because you, as well as writing, presenting, and so on, you did quite a number of interviews with various people, Woody Allen, Deborah Carr, and Ken Adam, Coppola, and Clint Eastwood.
Yes, yes.
Who is a bit of a hero.
Yes, indeed.
How was the interview?
Well, it was in the rather strange... Well, one of them, I've met him a couple of times, but in Claridge's, in the rather strange setting of a large suite of rooms in Claridge's. He's very unlike the characters that he plays, a little bit like Woody Allen, whom you mentioned, that because he's played the same part quite a lot of times, people think that's him.
Yeah.
But actually, he's very different as a personality. Soft-spoken Californian voice, vegetarian tendencies, fanatical anti-smoker, and this is the guy that made the cheroot unbelievably cool in the 1960s
course,
in
yes,
those spaghetti westerns.
Absolutely.
And in fact, during the interview, I said to him, I smoked in those days,
yeah,
and I lit up a cigarette in the interview, and he said, I wish you wouldn't do that. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, and I stubbed it out, and I said, but forgive me, you know, you're the man who made smoking unbelievably cool and everything. And his eyes narrowed. He said, I guess I never thought about it like that. And I thought, oh, don't go there. This could be dangerous. No, he's a herbivore, really, and he always plays carnivores.
Yes.
You know, the idea of Dirty Harry with a hamburger in one hand, yeah, and a Colt 44 Magnum in the other is a long way away from his personality. He's also a keep fit fanatic. You know, he jogs.
Yes.
He can jog for about 5 miles without leaving his back garden in Carmel. And so I found that interesting, you know,
yes,
the difference between his public persona and his private. So very thoughtful, occasionally would get up and play jazz piano. There was a little baby grand in this room in Claridge's,
yes,
and he's playing, you know, Thelonious Monk or something. And so I found all that. I did on BBC Two, in those days, they used to have seasons of films on television, the films of Woody Allen, the films of Deborah Carr, the films of gathered together as a season.
Yeah.
And I would do the documentary which headed up that season by,
yeah,
interviewing the person, mentioning all the films in the season.
Because, yeah,
you're allowed to use the clips free, up to,
yes,
3 minutes, as a trailer for the
interview
season.
Yeah.
As long as you put the programme out just before the season. And I had a wonderful time meeting all these people and doing long interviews with them and then sewing together the programmes. Then, of course, along comes video and DVD, and those seasons just weren't fashionable,
no,
anymore,
no,
or just at the National Film Theatre or something.
Yes.
And so they don't do it anymore, but it was a lot of fun while it lasted.
Obviously, Clint was a sort of hero, but I'm now going to talk about a real hero in your life, and that's Sir Henry Cole. Now, I listened to your lecture, actually, coming up from Dorset yesterday in my car. And I have to say, my ignorance, I knew very little about him. But your lecture was incredibly informative and enjoyable. And I saw so many links with what you've done through your life, the Faculty of Royal Designers for Industry. He seemed to be the grandfather of modern,
yeah,
design education.
Definitely.
And I know that you've got photograph him above your,
yes,
writing.
A print. Yes, a print
in,
from Vanity.
In Bath, and he was born in Bath as well.
Yes.
No,
it's strange. I mean, you know, everyone talks about the Great Exhibition and all those Victorian events taking design seriously for the first time, as if they're Prince Albert's idea.
Yes.
Actually, the civil servant who did all the work, who was his number two, who enabled it to happen and exhausted himself, actually, getting the Great Exhibition together, getting the penny post together, getting the British Railways on a single gauge. I mean, he's an extraordinary man, amazing creative energy, was Henry Cole, who people haven't heard of. It's extraordinary, you know, the sort of backroom boy in a way. So, yes, and he, you know, he was the first director of the what we now call the V&A,
yes,
the Museum of Manufactures, the South Kensington Museum, which in those days was the same institution as the Royal College. And I love that Victorian idea,
yes,
which was exported to America. You know, if you go to Philadelphia, the museum and the art school are part of the same building,
yes,
and it was very much an innovative idea of it. You go in one entrance, you get museum, you go in another, you get young practitioners, and the two are integral to one another. If you go to the cast court at the V&A, all those plaster casts of famous sculptures, they are actually the visual aids department of the Royal College of Art. I like to remind the V&A of this occasionally. Now they've become a great exhibit in their own right.
Of course.
But why did you have all those casts assembled in South Kensington? So that the students could copy them,
yes,
without having to go to Rome to see Trajan's Column or whatever it was.
Yes.
So you do a plaster cast of it, or Michelangelo's David, you put it up in South Kensington, and the students all sketch from it.
Yes.
So the whole sort of shape of the V&A originally was because it was integrally connected with an art school. And that,
yes,
was Henry Cole, who,
yes,
was manager of both of them.
Well, I also love this little story you told about the Chamber of Horrors, this exhibition that he put together, really displaying the good and bad of design.
Yeah.
And you said in your interview that it's something you would like to do in this age.
No, in fact, I pitched the idea at the Design Council. It went down like a lead balloon, actually.
Oh, did
it? Well, the idea of in fact, they tried it at the Boiler House under Stephen Bailey, where they had an exhibition on taste,
yes,
if you remember.
I do.
And they had sort of resting on dustbins, bad taste, and resting on beautifully modernist plinths, good taste. And it was very controversial.
Yes.
And it was indeed with Henry Cole, where you'd walk round
not only would you have what they considered examples of bad design, but crucially, next to them, why that judgment had been made. So you had the principles of, and in those days they had very firm sort of Victorian principles of design that, you know, direct imitation of nature, too fussy. You can't, you know...
Horses on wallpaper.
Yeah, horses on wallpaper. You know, wallpapers, you know, you're not supposed to have horses on wallpaper, etc. But at least it was being explicit about the criteria of judgment, which was very useful to the public who needed guidance in that area. So I was fantasizing about, okay, supposing you had an exhibition at the V&A where you reenact the Chamber of Horrors. So I managed to track down about two-thirds of the original exhibits, many of which weren't catalogued at the V&A because they were so ashamed of having done this. They were sort of in the basement. But so you could start with a reenactment of the Chamber of Horrors, and you'd then do the Chamber of Horrors 2018. And it would be very interesting because, first of all, you'd see that several of the Victorian horrors subsequently became very fashionable. Flock wallpaper, which at the time was absolutely the pits. You try and go to an Indian restaurant that hasn't got them, you know. I'm not saying it's that fashionable, but it's there in the culture. And so that would be interesting. Yesterday's horrors are today's fashion. But also would be a bit stimulating to think, why has he got a simulated log fire as one of the horrors? Why is it, what the other one of the horrors I was going to have was those little buckets of milk that you get, little plastic buckets, where however you open them, it ends up all over your shirt. And that would be a horror from a sort of practical point of view. And so you'd have also, and you'd have little things next to it, why have I chosen it? But they all said, for God's sake, you're going to irritate the manufacturers, nobody will sponsor us ever again if they think
and
they
could
ever be a sponsor.
And of course, whatever you judge as bad, a whole raft of young creatives will say, absolutely not. No, this is a great form of inspiration.
No, no, exactly. And also, judgments of taste went very much out of fashion. That the democratic thing, I mean, this is a big subject, but while I was on the Arts Council and on the Design Council, there's a big shift going on between how these public bodies should be associated with the people who produce things to it should also they should also be very involved with the people who consume things. And so the audience, the consumer, the person on the receiving end became part of the point of public subsidy. And that was a big, big change in the 1990s. And so it would be impossible to say, this is about taste. I'm going to tell you what's good and what's bad. That was absolutely anathema because anything goes. They're all consumers. They're all taxpayers. They're all lottery players. So they all have a right to a point of view. So that would have been unbelievably... Nevertheless, I think it would have been exciting. The controversy would have been interesting because it would have teased out a lot of these issues.
Would. A little aside about Cole, did you know that he was the person that really invented the Christmas card?
Indeed. I have seen the original Christmas card in the V&A, and it came out in the same year as Dickens's A Christmas Carol. And if you look at it, it's very similar to A Christmas Carol. In the middle is good cheer. He got into trouble because everyone's holding a wine glass, and all these temperance organisations said that's
very
a bit
big,
un-PC. And then you folded it out, and here were charitable works either side. So you've got the poor outside the door, inside plum pudding and good cheer, and outside, which is exactly the theme of A Christmas Carol. And it was exactly at that moment. Yeah, and that was the first commercial Christmas card.
I'm going to move on to Misha Black, because you got the Sir Misha Black Award in 2003.
Yeah.
And Misha Black, of course, was a former Master of the Royal Designers for Industry. And he was involved in an exhibition in the very year of your birth, 1946, called Britain Can Make It, Good Design and Good Business, at the V&A.
Yes.
Another one of... And of course, he connects right back to Henry Cole. There's this kind of lineage, you know, going right through.
Yes, Britain Can Make It, which was subtitled by some of the newspapers, But Britain Can't Have It, because it was at the time of rationing after the Second World War, was until recently the most successful exhibition the V&A has ever put on in terms of footfall.
I've seen photographs.
Huge, absolute queues. And the centrepiece of it was designed by Misha Black, which was the design of an egg cup. And what he did was he chose the most mundane of things in those days on breakfast, pre-cholesterol. Everyone had an egg for breakfast.
Yes.
And so the egg cup was absolutely ubiquitous. And he wanted to choose a really mundane object that everyone took for granted, and they didn't imagine anyone had designed it. And so you take the egg cup and you look at all the processes, the original design, the manufacturing, the tooling up, the materials that it was made of, and that was the centerpiece of the exhibition. A little bit like Adam Smith's great book on economics, which kind of founded economics, The Wealth of the Nations, early 19th century, where he takes the example of a pin factory. Very, very mundane example. The centrepiece of the Wealth of the Nations is how does a pin factory work? Well, the centrepiece of Britain Can Make It was how does an egg cup work? Mm. Brilliant idea. Mm. Had he chosen a Ferrari or a sort of a big deal version of design, he wouldn't have taught people much because they always associate that with designers.
Of course.
That's top end stuff, designed with a big D. But he chose something that was designed with a little D, and that was brilliant.
Yeah. I'm going to talk a little bit further about design education, because a report that came out earlier this year revealed that 90% of secondary schools are having to cut back on the creative subjects. And I know that Sir Ken Robinson, who I'm sure you know, has long been an outspoken advocate of the importance of art in schools. And I wonder what your current view is on that.
I think it's a complete disaster. I mean, when I was chairman of the Design Council, by dint of much persuasion, we managed to persuade the powers that be that design and technology was part of the core curriculum. And the result was, it was the fourth most popular subject in all secondary schools, was design and technology. And then we did a survey on what's the attraction, and interestingly, a very high percentage loved design and technology because they all wanted to design video games in those days. You know, they wanted to do Tomb Raider sort of thing, which shocked the Design Council. Yes. It didn't surprise me very much, but it shocked the Design Council. They thought they all wanted to make, you know, craft pots and all the rest of it.
Yes.
But that was great. Then, with the baccalaureate and the EBAC and all the rest of it debate, suddenly D&T and art are no longer part of the core curriculum. Mm. And so schools which are highly stretched economically emphasize the 3 R's, and they shunt the visual subjects out. As a result, design technology has fallen off a cliff.
Yes.
I'm talking to you at the end of 2018, it is falling daily.
Yes.
And the knock-on effect is that it's having an effect on art schools, which are dropping a lot of the subjects which people aren't applying for. That was inevitable. You know, once schools stop doing it, then art schools stop doing it, unless you want to people the courses entirely with foreign students.
Mm.
And so, it's very, very
dramatic.
So
you're rather pessimistic.
Oh, incredibly,
about
yes. And I thought in the era, you mentioned creative industries and how it came and went.
Yeah.
In that era, I thought that was won, that battle was won for all time.
Mm.
It turned out it was a temporary game, and it slipped when the wind changed.
It's
and
kind
I think that's very, very sad.
Bit of political wallpapering at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's gone. And I think it's very, very sad. But I suppose one of the saving graces is if what sticks, and this was one of Ken Robinson's points, is if you teach a designerly attitude, whatever you're studying, so that you don't have to actually do D&T to be a designer, but you have a designerly attitude to studying the First World War,
or you
have a designerly attitude towards doing maths, whatever it is, engineering,
then
maybe something has stuck.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I think it's very, very sad, not least because it'll mean that the private sector is where most of the design goes on.
Yeah.
And because they can afford to have a design room and they can afford to be a little bit more flexible where the national curriculum is concerned.
Yeah.
And so you're going to get art schools people with public school people. And I'm not sure that's particularly healthy either.
No. Well, we're coming to the end now. I mean, you are a multifaceted person. There's no two ways about that. Looking at, you know, the body of what you've done, you've packed in, you know, what a normal person, you know, would just not be able to do. So I'm wondering if there's anything that you haven't done that you want to do still.
Gosh, I'd love to write the script of a feature film.
Ah.
I've done a lot of work for television, a lot of work for radio, and that's great. But years ago...
Well, we're in the right place.
Indeed we are. Here we are in BAFTA. I wrote a script years ago of a Western...
Uh-huh.
Called Jack Slade, Desperado, and this is in the 80s, and the gimmick was that it was all about a gunfighter's girlfriend and how she kept rescuing him from all sorts of scrapes, and that Jack Slade kept getting into all these difficulties, and his girlfriend was waiting, and she protected him from hanging, and she was quick on the draw and so on. That was a kind of feminist Western, was the idea of it. And a poster was mocked up, and it went to the Cannes Film Festival with a Dutch producer. And I've got it somewhere. It has Jack Slade, Desperado, screenplay by Christopher Frayling. And then it said, starring John Cassavetes asterisk, and Jane Fonda, asterisk. And then it said at the bottom, subject to availability, because he hadn't even asked them, but he was trying to get investment. And it was like the producers or something. It was completely mad. But it was a great moment. It was the nearest I've got, actually. But
you should have that frame. You're now, rather like me, in my 70s, you know, we're getting on a bit.
Yeah.
What drives you? You still, I mean, it's taken me a long time to get this interview together because you've been so busy.
I don't know. I'm just that sort of person. I like being busy. Yes. I don't like. You know, when I was on Desert Island Discs, I said, you know, the last thing I want is to sit on a desert island being introspective, thinking about myself all the time. Yes. I have a slight hypochondriac tendency, so when I'm by myself, I tend to worry about my ailments and things.
Oh, I
mean, all that. I like to look up and just get on with life, really. Yes. I'm just that kind of person. And also, you know, I was once asked what my philosophy of life was, and I said it's like that road sign. When they introduced the yellow box on the road, do you remember, at the road junction?
Absolutely.
There was a road sign that said, do not enter yellow box unless your exit is clear. Well, that's my rule of life. That whatever I'm doing, I want an exit route and I want something else going on at the same time. Do not enter yellow box unless your exit is clear. So that's how I still feel.
Okay, last question. Over the years, you've given lectures to the RDIs, you've been involved with the RDIs, and more recently you were involved for a very short time, unfortunately, but... What's your view? What's your view as so many of them actually pass through the Royal College of Art?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I remember going to Fiona MacArthur's exhibition in 1986 at the V&A, which was the 50th birthday of the RDIs.
Yeah.
And of course, when I became chairman of the design committee of the RSA, it was the 80th birthday, so it's 30 years later. But I looked a little bit at the archives of the RDI, and I saw that right from its origins, it's been quite a contested group of people who were sort of arguing about... This is a strength, by the way. I'm not saying this is a weakness.
No.
So when it starts, it's supposed to be Royal Designers for industry. But actually, all the early RDIs are craftspeople. They're the Eric Gills and the Cockerels and people, Ethel Meres and people like that.
Yep.
Then in the Second World War, it's the Boffins. So you get Geoffrey de Havilland and Barnes Wallis. You know, the engineers move in. Then in the swinging 60s, photography, fashion for the first time, more graphics and so on. And in Fiona's exhibition, I noticed in 1986, 45 industrial designers, 20 graphic designers, 13 textile designers, 6 fashion designers. And so, and they're all contested areas. Big debate, should we allow engineers in? Should we allow photographers in? Should we allow film designers in? And today, the debate is, should we allow service designers, virtual designers, interaction designers? And when I took over the committee, the RSA said, well, you know, it's all a bit contested, as if contesting design was in some way a weakness. I said, they've always done that. The whole point about the RDI is it's a dynamic group of talented individuals who have rows all the time about where are the borders of the subject. That goes right back to 1936, where actually the word industry was an aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't real at all in 1936.
No.
Otherwise, they didn't have any industrial designers. The profession hadn't organized itself yet in that way. And so it was, to start with, it was aspirational, then it became real. I mean, the one worry I had about your redesign of the Royal Design, you know, the image, the brand, was that you removed the word industry. You had Royal Designers.
I didn't actually.
Oh, right.
That,
okay.
That's the official title is still there on the letterheading.
Yes.
But as a shorthand.
Yes. No. Exactly.
But it, so I, it's I, the old IBM.
But I quite like the I. You see, I think that makes it. I'm not. It's not a criticism, but I quite like the I because that makes it unique.
Yes.
There's lots of organisations where designers pat each other on the back and give each other prizes.
Yes, of course.
But this is RDI with a notion of industry, with a changing notion of industry. Mm. But I do think the I is important, and it's a very broad I. You've got Quentin Blake, so it's the publishing industry. You've got the fashion industry. You've got Wallace and Gromit, the animation industry.
Yes.
I mean, there's many different I's, but I do think that makes it distinctive. But, you know, the plan for that committee was to... And so this is quite an interesting area, really. I remember when at the Royal College when we had discussions about giving fellowships, and we were a self-elected body of fellow professionals who decided who should be in the club. And in the 80s and 90s, the world changed with words like accountability and structure and admin, and suddenly that notion seemed out of time a little bit.
Yes.
And so the gears began to grind between that kind of body and the world that surrounded us, which was using a whole new language of accountability and structure and so on. And exactly the same, I think the RDIs got away with it in the Thatcher era. It didn't happen. Mm. But by the 90s and the noughties, suddenly two ideologies were colliding, which
yes.
is the organization of the RSA, and within it, the RDIs, this fellowship yes. of fellow professionals. And so my job was to try and sort of stop the gears grinding quite so
yes.
much. What happened, of course, was by providing a forum, a platform, it made it worse, because it actually enabled the shouting to take place in a committee room rather than, you know, in the comfort of one's own room.
Yes.
And so I quickly realized, actually, this is part of the problem, not part of the solution,
no.
which was a shame, because I'm a peacemaker, and I thought if anyone can make peace between these warring factions, I can. But unfortunately, it was, you know...
Well, as you probably now know, we're an association.
Yeah.
We've been...
I think that's a good result, actually.
So we're connected still because...
No, but something good came out of it,
yes,
I think, because it kind of forced discussion about how to reconfigure the relationship
yes.
so it works better.
Yes.
And that's what's happened. Let's hope it works
yes.
well. You know, because I believe in it so much for all sorts of reasons. And you know, and I noticed that recently, you know, recent RDIs, Tim Berners-Lee with the internet, Brian Eno, sound design, waterfall interactions, animation, that... It is a kind of trauma for the RDIs
yes.
to move into the virtual world and service design. But it was a trauma to introduce engineers. It was a trauma to introduce photographers.
Yes.
But this happened.
It always is. You know, I remember the very first time I went, I was made an RDI, I went into the meeting in trepidation. I said very little because there was Abraham Game. There was
yeah.
Alan Fletcher,
yeah.
there was Robin Lucien Day.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole raft of great
gods.
People.
It was like the Valhalla.
And yes, and people would sort of really object to people being put forward, particularly in new areas. So
yeah.
it is a fight, but eventually
it comes out. And I think it's a great organisation. And, you know, let's face it, you know, there aren't many organisations of highly talented individuals at the top end of their profession actually celebrating what they do publicly. And I think, you know, let's hear it for the RDIs, actually.
And it is the only cross-disciplinary
yeah.
organisation.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at that exhibition in 86, and by the way, I do think that the RDIs should do another exhibition.
I know.
You know, you mentioned Britain Can Make It. The year after Britain Can Make It, the RDIs did an exhibition called Designers at Work.
That's right. I've got the RA. The catalogue, yes.
And, you know, and then came 1986 at the V&A for the 50th birthday. I think, you know,
the
time is right to take stock. It is a history of British design.
Yes.
And not just British design. In the late 50s, all those emigres from Central Europe, the Henrians,
yes.
the Misha Blacks, all those people suddenly, you know, enter the club. It's not just Britain. European emigres nourishing Britain.
Plus, we have honorees from around the world.
Raft of people nourishing the British mainstream from the European avant-garde.
Yes.
And it's a really interesting moment in the late 50s. And, you know, as we talk, Brexit is happening all around us.
Yes.
And that was embracing the European influence within the British establishment in a way that's sort of inconceivable at the moment.
I mean,
rather sad.
It's all sad. Right, very last question. What advice would you give a young person who actually wants to pursue a creative life in the current climate, knowing that the industry itself, because of the digital age, has exploded? You go to Hoxton and every other doorway is a design company. So it's a massive... What advice would you give?
Gosh. Well, number one, treat technology as a tool rather than an end in itself. And don't try and second-guess technology and have an aesthetic that looks all technological, because I don't think that ever works. Number two, never set out to write a bestseller, because you won't. If you, to thine own self be true, if you find your own voice, if you're very, very lucky, and if the cards fall right, it might become a bestseller. But if you say to yourself, I want to write a bestseller, so you do a bit of audience research and say, oh, hang on, what are the elements? And that's always a disaster. It leads to blandness. And, you know, keep the energy up. Keep bashing, you know, David Hockney's philosophy of art education. Keep bumping your head against the establishment that surrounds you, because that's the way you'll find your own voice.
That's
the sort of advice.
I think that's great advice coming from somebody that's done that all his life. Professor Sir Christopher Frayling, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for this great interview.